ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife History.
Well, these days, pharmaceuticals and potentially dangerous medicinal drugs are very tightly regulated, as they should be, to prevent poisoning and abuse. But early last century, it was a very different story. Pretty much any concoction could be called medicine, and potions and miracle cures. There are all sorts of quackery, easily sold to the public as remedies to any ailment you could possibly imagine. Well, this week, in 1907, a growing push by the Australian states for some sort of control saw the first steps towards regulation of patent medicines, and legislation would require ingredients to be labelled and advertising claims to align with provable health outcomes. To give us some insights into this push for a very necessary change of the time, we're joined once again by Michael Adams, creator and host of the Forgotten Australia podcast. Michael joins us every fortnight with these historical snapshots, looking at what was happening in particular weeks across the years. Michael, good evening to you. Welcome back.
Thanks, Phil.
Gee, it was the Wild West back in 1907 when it came to drugs on offer. Talk about snake oil. That was the least of your problems.
You'd probably be better off with snake oil. It really was anything goes, although at this time in 1907, things were starting to change very, very slowly after basically a century or so of completely unregulated industry in which anybody could make any claim for any substance. And it was, you know, basically, you know, Russian roulette when you reach for a pill or a bottle.
Yes, there were a lot of big patent medicine brands, weren't there?
There were.
Doane's backache kidney pills, for example. Yeah. What were some of the others?
Hearn's bronchitis cure, Zambuck, which we know could cure all of your skin irritations, including your hemorrhoids. There was Freeman's chlorodyne, which was a particularly pernicious one. There were Dr. Morse's Indian root pills.
Oh, yeah, that was. Yeah. I still remember those. Were they around for long?
They're still available, I think, in the United States now as a herbal. They were always, I think, just a herbal supplement that made, you know, extraordinary claims to heal your deranged liver, as they would call it. So they really did range from placebos.
Bonington's Irish Moss.
Bonington's Irish Moss, which is still available now.
That's still available?
Yep, yeah. As
that's
a cough
kind
syrup.
Of a lolly, isn't it?
It's cough, you know, a cough syrup you can get at the supermarket. Hmm. But, you know, in 1906, 1907, it was in 1907, even though laws had been passed in Victoria banning the over-the-counter sale of opium, Bonington's then still contained opium, and an inspector went into a pharmacy in Carlton, bought a couple of bottles, had it analysed, charged the pharmacy, and Bonington's went into sort of damage control mode and had to withdraw all of their bottles from Victorian shelves and replace them with a non-opiate-based formula.
Wow.
But opiates were still available and still legal over-the-counter in other states, so it would take a while before Bonington's was, you know, brought into a non-morphine-based sort of environment. Yeah, and this was, you know, a situation that was replicated over dozens of really big brand patent medicines that contained opiates, cocaine, cannabis, alcohol, especially alcohol.
Yeah. There was a lot of it around, wasn't there? Opium, cocaine, chloroform, cannabis, alcohol. These are they were common enough. I mean, the age-old story about Coca-Cola having cocaine in it.
Yeah.
At least for a very short period of the initial times, I think.
I don't think it did by the time it got to Australia, Coca-Cola, because by then cocaine had been banned from over-the-counter sales. It was a prescription drug. Mm. But, yeah, when I think about patent medicines, doing the podcast for the past 10 years and the books, I think I've been exposed to tens of thousands of these ads, and they've sort of become just this wallpaper.
For a second, you're saying for 10 years you've been on Dr. Morse's Indian root pills.
I'd be in trouble if I had. They became this sort of amusing, quirky wallpaper, and you kind of associate it with the medicine man, you know, the sort of character in a caravan who's just doling out harmless concoctions. But when you look at it, these were big international companies that wielded a lot of power, economic power. You know, the Australian government was getting tariffs from the importation of these things. State governments got revenue from, you know, big advertising billboards around all the railway stations. The newspapers for decades were propped up by advertising revenue. There was one issue of the Evening News that I looked at, which actually had a story about quackery and its ills. And in that one 8-page Sydney newspaper, there was a half a page of varying quack patent ads. So that amount of money and influence would take would mean that the patent medicine regulations would take a long time to sort of be implemented because the companies would push back internationally.
Mm. They claimed to cure all sorts of things, didn't they? But they also used real people for testimonials. That was the important thing, wasn't it?
They did. I mean, that's where I sort of entered the story with the most recent episode of the podcast, was a Mr. A. Bennett of 56 George Street, St. Peter's, who was, you know, depicted with a top hat and tails, waiting for a train with, oh, my aching back sort of thing, and then talking about how Doan's kidney pills had back in the day set him right, and he'd been right ever since. And I looked him up on the electoral rolls, and he was a real person, Albert Bennett, who lived in St. Peter's at the time and was a railway shunter. So they would use these real people, these testimonials, and Doan's did this all over the world. And some of these, you know, people's, their names would be used for 10 years or more. Doan's was a diuretic. So, you know, if you felt like you were a bit stopped up, it might help. Mm. But it also, its active ingredient was potassium nitrate, you know, which is great for making explosives and fertilizers. It's less kind on the human body in repeated doses. And ironically enough, what it does is inflame and damage the kidneys. So if you were taking Doan's pills on the regular for your kidneys, you were more than likely injuring your kidneys. I mean, these days, Doan's are still on sale in the United States, and it just contains a mild sort of analgesic and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. So these days, something like that would actually help ease your pain. But that wasn't the claim. The claim was that these quack medicines cured you. And, you know, I guess one of the most outrageous claims was, you know, made for Hearns and made for Bonington's and a whole bunch of similar cold and flu medications that, you know, did contain morphine, opium, chloroform, cannabis, alcohol. One of their big claims was that they cured consumption. And, of course, consumption is tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is not curable with any sort of medicine along those lines. And it's, you know, since it was sort of categorized in 1882, the disease has killed 1.2 billion people and it still kills 1.4 million per year. It's the biggest killer infectious disease in human history. So all of these medicines were not curing that. And their claims that, you know, if you took these medicines, you'd be impervious to a cough and therefore consumption gave people a real false sense of security. At the same time, they were risking addiction, overdose, and so on. The other horrible thing that I sort of learned by digging into this was that these medicines were given to children. So if you look at, you know, Hearns, you know, and none of these, that was the big issue as well, was none of these medicines had to have anything on the labels about what they contained. So you might know that, you know, there's a bit of opium and some alcohol in X or Y blend, but you don't know how much and you don't know if the formula changes, whether that goes up or down. One of the instructions was, you know, for a three-month-old baby, you had to give 5 minims, which is about 0.3 of a milliliter, 3 times a day. Mm. Now, when you're using something that's got morphine and chloroform in it on a three-month-old baby, if you get that wrong, the baby's going to possibly die. And this was the thing. One of the biggest killers of infants worldwide and in Australia was diarrhea. And these medicines, these sort of opiate-based medicines, they would actually suppress diarrhea. So they did have a positive effect. And you've got to remember that people at this time didn't have access to good medical care. So you would give these soothers to these babies to stop them dying from diarrhoea, but you were risking overdosing them on these concoctions.
There'd been a Royal Commission, that wasn't there? And there was a report published in August 1907.
That's right.
So they knew there was a problem. So what happened as a result? There were some changes, weren't there?
There were changes. It would take a long time. So a guy called Octavius Beale, who was a racist, a eugenicist, he believed that the white race was being debased and deranged by all sorts of things, including patent medicines. He took it upon himself to actually approach the Prime Minister Alfred Deakin and say, hey, I'll do this Royal Commission and I'll pay for it. So he had some very sort of repugnant motivations that were tackling, but he was tackling an issue that was of concern, patent medicines. So he went all over the world, studied, interviewed experts, he paid for analysis, and he published it all in this report, ran to almost 500 pages. So you could open it up and you could see the actual chemical composition or compounds that were in various medications. There was proof that, you know, something like Doane's contained potassium nitrate, or that, you know, Hearn's contained morphine and
So did the law change to make sure they had to list these things?
What the law is, there'd be varying responses. The House of Representatives introduced a bill which would require imported medicines to be labelled, their ingredients to be labelled. Various state governments started to pass laws that either banned over the counter sale of, you know, morphine, opiates, cocaine and so forth, or made it a requirement that if it was over the counter, everything had to be labelled on the side. Of course, we're talking about, you know, cocaine and opium and alcohol and so forth, but then there were other compounds that were being used that might actually be, you know, good for relieving pain, but also had terrible effects. I mean, Bex was one of the big ones that was, you know, after this, and it was a legitimate medicine, but it was also doing terrible damage to people's kidneys. So it would be a really long process. And, you know, there was one thing I read which I could just barely believe was that they had narcotic opiate, morphine-based sweets, lozenges that were marketed to children in the early 1900s. And there were also door-to-door salesmen who would actually come to your house with opiate-based medicines. And if you weren't home, they'd leave a sample on your doorstep. And it was in this Royal Commission, a health commissioner in New South Wales said, you know, this is incredibly dangerous. You know, kids pick these up and they eat them and they overdose. And that actual process of door-to-door peddling of opiates wouldn't be stamped out for almost 20 years. So it took a long time for these things to be reined in and correctly labelled, and for people to have enough information to be able to make informed decisions.
It proves the one, I suppose, that age-old marketing thing, isn't it? It's not what the product is, it's the brand.
It's the brand.
If you create a brand and a desire for and a demand for the brand, then that's the whole point.
Well, the thing is, like, you know, even after some of these things were stripped of their sort of, you know, stronger compounds, they were still marketed because, you know, it was...
Everyone knew the brand.
They knew the brand. There was a placebo effect involved. It wasn't going to do any harm. So, you know, the Mr. Bennett from 1907 with his top hat and tails, you skip 60 years ahead and you see a guy who looks like he stepped out of Mad Men in illustration in a Don's commercial in the Canberra Times. Exactly the same message. So, yeah, these brands were very, very popular. And you could kind of argue that, you know, we didn't really ever stamp quackery out. It just sort of rebranded, made itself less harmful.
And these days it's called AI.
Well, these days it's called wellness. And, you know, that's such a broad term. But it's worth, in Australia, about $200 billion a year. It's an absolutely ginormous industry. And, you know, the claims that are made, I mean, one of the things that I read from Harvard University was that, and people probably know this, that, you know, in 2023 there was an article basically saying that most over-the-counter cough medicines do very little, if anything. And that's a, you know, US $30 billion a year industry. So are we still living in quackery? I think we kind of are.
Most vitamins do nothing. But people buy them. Look at the acres of shelf space devoted to them.
Absolutely.
Yep. Lessons for today. But quackery was with us then, and unfortunately still with us. Michael, terrific to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.